Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride.
It's hard to know where to begin in introducing this week's conversation with Father Gregory Boyle. This was a big one for us. When we found out that Father Greg would be willing to talk to us about his new book, Barking to the Choir, we jumped at the chance to fly to LA and spend the day at Homeboy Industries. His story is well known, but in the wake of the 92 LA riots, Father Greg launched Homeboy Bakery in the middle of downtown Los Angeles. Homeboy Industries provides hope, training, and support to former gang members and previously incarcerated men and women, allowing them to redirect their lives and becoming contributing members of their communities. They're welcome into a community of mutual kinship, love, and a wide variety of services ranging from tattoo removal to anger management to parenting classes. They offer full-time employment to more than 200 men and women at a time through an 18-month program that helps them re-identify who they are in the world. It's an understatement to say it's an amazing place. Homeboy Industries is the largest and most successful gang rehabilitation and reentry program in the world. They offer what they call an exit ramp for those stuck in the cycle of violence and incarceration. They offer therapeutic and educational classes like the ones I mentioned, but also practical services like work readiness and legal assistance and job training in businesses like Homeboy Bakery, Homegirl Cafe, and Homeboy Silkscreen and Embroidery. And with all of it, the aim is to provide healing alternatives to gang life while creating safer and more healthy communities. Shannon and I, we both look forward to this conversation for weeks, which is probably a bad idea. Usually, you know, when you're talking with somebody as big as Father Greg, who's been on all the big TV shows, all the talk shows, all the big podcasts, you know, has a couple of best-selling books, you know, you wonder if he's going to have the time, you know, to be present with us. But we realized pretty quickly that's not really a concern with Father Greg. From the minute we stepped into Homeboy Bakery and started meeting the former gang members who work there, started not so much looking around, but feeling around at the vibe of the place, at the cocoon of warmth that Father Greg and his staff have created, we felt like we'd come home. Shannon writes this week about our day with the homies. And I won't repeat her here, but pretty simply, it was one of my favorite days on this planet. Being with Father Greg and the other people we interviewed was beyond wonderful, but what I think I'll remember most is looking into the smiling eyes of homie after homie after homie. Nothing more, nothing less. To be quite honest, before that day, if I'd seen any one of those intimidating tattooed faces walking past me on a street in downtown LA, I would have found a way to study my shoelaces quick. But not that day. And I hope not ever again. When Father Greg refers to the luminous now in this conversation, he's describing our entire day perfectly. Our friends at Encore.org helped us set up conversations with Greg and Homeboy Industries CEO Tom Bazzo and mentor-mentee Connie and Laura that we'll be featuring in the coming weeks. And our new friend from Encore, Sarah McKinney Gibson, spent the day there with us. You'll hear her in the following conversation with Greg. After 3 hours of interviews, we kind of stumbled out onto the sidewalk into the LA sunshine, and Sarah looked at us and said, "I kind of feel like I'm high after all those conversations, the euphoria of it." And then Shannon and I just kind of like looked at each other and nodded through our tears. Another thing Greg says is how savoring the world, rather than saving, through meeting people on out there on what we refer to as the margins, is a supremely selfish act. I love that quote. Shannon and I just nod through our tears. You'll hear Shannon tell Greg in this conversation how she'd been trying and failing for days to explain to me that idea of savoring versus saving people. But she was wrong. We understood each other perfectly. What I've realized is that this work that we're doing is for nobody but us. This work of conversation, of trying to reclaim our vision of conversation, is just us sustaining ourselves. But it feels vital. It feels enough. It feels like that's okay. Not the sharing part that you guys hopefully see and read and listen to, but the conversations, you know, with our storytellers, yeah, but I'm talking about the conversations we have between us. You know, those are, I guess, for me, those are the most important ones. We still have three young, you know, growing kids, and we've been in the thick of it for the last decade, probably like a lot of you guys who are listening. And it's scary sometimes how buried you become in this middle part of life. Not just the constant churn of school and work and games and stuff like that, but the emotional churn as we grow older and our kids grow older. Everything about life seems to be set up for us not to have conversations, you know, except for conversations about who's picking who up. But as I told Sarah out on the sidewalk, these conversations, this work is therapy. You know, it's like marriage therapy for us. And in the 20 years we've been together, I don't think we've ever understood each other better, ever rooted for each other more, ever worked better together, ever lived in the luminous now like we do now. It was a big day for us. This conversation was a big one for us. But what I love is that every day is a big day for us. Every conversation is a big conversation for us. And we're so glad you're along for the ride.
I wanted to just read a little bit of something you wrote because I feel like it gets to the heart of what we're trying to ask about. You said the moment when says, this is what it's like for me, a rebirth occurs. Locating our wounds leads us to a gracious place of fragility, the contact point with another human being. When we share these shards of excavation with each other, we move into the intimacy of mutual healing. You know, we do our work with storytelling around conversation leading to healing that leads to wholeness, that leads to connection. And I just wanted you to kind of riff for us about what it's like when you have loving that flows both ways. In our intergenerational work, we talk a bit about adults helping young people, but it's really a reciprocity. I just wondered if that's something you could talk about and however it moves you.
Well, some of this comes from a notion of very simply Cesar Chavez, who was a friend and once a reporter had said to him, wow, these farm workers, they sure love you. And he said, the feeling's mutual. You know, and it's a very simple thing, you know. There's a lot of kind of cautionary tale in all this, you know, like you don't go to the margins to make a difference because then it has to be about you. There's no other way around that. Nobody can sit back and go, wow, he really made a difference on the margins. No, it's like it's only about you if you frame it that way. But if you go to the margins so that the folks at the margins make me different, then it's a different starting point. Then you're receiving people, you're listening to people. You're not going out to the margins to reach people. You're going out to the margins to be reached. Then just that stance alone allows for exquisite mutuality. Just that stance alone allows people to together inhabit their own dignity and their own goodness, you know, and the truth of who they are. So I think it's a kind of a stance. It's also beneficial because it means burnout can't happen. Because burnout happens because it's about you. Burnout happens because you're trying to save people and rescue people. But it's perfectly fine to be exhausted here. But it's not fine to be depleted. And you're only depleted if it's about you. You know, if you allow there to enter into this exquisite mutuality with people, where there's, I don't even want to say give and take, you know, it's just, it's all gift, you know, to be with people. Where you allow yourself to be reached by people. And just that act alone is an invitation to the other to and the soul feels its worth, you know. You appear, the soul feels its worth. You know, it's because, you know, people feel worthy because you are inviting them to reach you, and you go, wow, me? You're inviting me to reach you? You know, and it's not fake. It's really, you're delighting in the other person. And so that's kind of what you want. That's what you hope for. It's where the joy is. I mean, a lot of that is just being anchored in the present moment, you know, in the luminous now with another person. Rather than going, God, why did I say that 3 days ago? Or I'm kind of anxious about what will happen tomorrow. And you've lost the entire moment that you had with this person in your midst. So then you just breathe in the spirit that delights in your being, and you breathe that spirit into another human being. And that's the locus of joy, happiness. That's the only place it can, that it is available to you, is right there, right here and now with the other person. I think it's supremely selfish, you know, which is perfectly fine. Once you let go of that, you go, yeah, no, I need to receive you. I need to be reached by you. Yeah. You know, people will say all the time, wow, how's it feel to have saved all these lives? I go, I don't know what you're talking about. I really don't. And I don't mean that in a cute way, you know, or a coy way. It's just, I don't know. So, I think because that's the difficulty, you know. it's kind of part of our DNA a little bit, you know, where a woman came in here wanting to volunteer, and she said, oh my God, I have to volunteer at Homeboy. I said, why? Why do you have to volunteer? Well, I believe I have a message these young people need to hear. I went, yikes, please come back the minute you've lost that message, you know, because then we want you here. But we don't want message. We don't even want messengers. You know, we just want people who will have a high degree of reverence for who everybody is here, and then to receive them, you know.
I tried to articulate this to Mike for days, and I've struggled and failed. But I wanted to try to, if you could help me understand, I think it's around intention, because I think you said that in the beginning, but the difference in the about me savior, I'm coming to change the world, versus the selfishness of delighting in letting myself be seen and in response seeing you. They're both, you know, about us a little bit, but in a different, how would you nuance that?
Yeah, it's not just about listening. You know, because people will talk about, you know, be a good listener and all that kind of thing. It's more, you know, I talk about save the world or savor it. You know, and that we think saving the world is kind of this active stance. And that maybe savoring, wow, that feels so passive. And yet, you know, don't go to the margins to save the folks there, but go to the margins and savor the folks there. Wonder how people are doing, you know. Even if that little switch went off where he said, I'm not going to try to fix this person, I'm just going to wonder you know, how are you doing? You know, that's such a liberating stance and question around here, because we're all about relational wholeness. You know, how can you stay engaged? You know, I was in a meeting earlier, and one of the navigators, who's a homie, you know, and he says, you know, we got to stop watching them. We have to engage them. You know, so we say a lot that the homies here are used to being watched, like prison, but they're not used to being seen. And that's kind of what he was meaning. You know, it was like engage, especially the younger homies, because they're the toughest, you know, because they don't have any resilience, you know, and yet they're being drawn to real community, because real community will always trump gang. But once they get a taste of it, it's so foreign, and it's so interesting, and it's so alluring. And they go, yeah, I want this, you know. But they're a tough crowd to hold. So you have to quadruple team them. You have to really intentionally engage them. Not in a message-y way, you know. Like, there's this thing now in the country called credible messengers, as a way to kind of deal with gang, you know, it's sort of like take the gang member who's kind of reformed and moved on and have him be the, he's a credible messenger. And I go, no, that's completely off, you know, because first of all, it disqualifies everybody else, which is crazy, because if you're the proud owner of a pulse, then you can be a beneficial presence, you can savor somebody. You can be reached by this person. So it doesn't matter, like, you know, only gang members can connect to gang members. That's crazy, you know. And so you want to be able to, you know, allow yourself to have your heart altered by people and be willing to do that. So it's not about message and it's not about messenger. You know, it's about people walking with others, you know.
Yeah, you read about lining the hallways. The metaphor, the image in your book that was my favorite. Lining the hallways until you...
Well, because sometimes the hallway is the... you don't want to get stuck there, first of all, you know, because, well, we say that the service is the hallway that leads to the ballroom, which is the place of a community of kinship, which is the goal. But in order to get there, there's a kind of a hallway that's kind of halfway between here and there. And the notion of lining the hallway is to kind of support people as they make that transition, especially in gang life, from a false kind of communion and community. It's a one false move kind of place. Mm-hmm. To the real kinship, which is a no matter whatness place. So there's the hallway, and so all these folks here line the hallway and kind of go, you can do it, it's okay, keep going, because they're not quite there yet. Although there, a homie came and saw me the other day, and he said, you know, I didn't know him. He said, I'm tired of being gangfully employed, which really cracked me up. And he said, well, you know what my problem is? I go, what? Menopause. Which made me laugh. But he didn't laugh. Dead serious. He thought menopause was some kind of pause between being a boy and a man. That a boy is somebody who gangbangs. And a man is somebody who's decided, I'm not going to do that anymore. And he was going, I'm just pulled back and forth. You know, menopause, he said. I go, well, it works for me. And of course, the rule around here is if you're a gang member who makes me laugh, you start work the next day. I'm kind of not very discriminating that way. But that was the thing. That was the notion. And I thought, well, you know, because it was some kind of fluctuating... you know, straddling of a fence between boyhood and manhood, and I know no man gangbangs. He was able to say that, and yet I'm still being pulled back to that thing, you know.
Yeah.
anyway.
There's so many beautiful stories in the new book about that type of thing, of you savoring the world through bringing homies with you on trips and watching them grow into their stories. Mm-hmm. To me, this book feels almost more joyous than your last. And I know you've been, you know, dealing with an illness through the time since your last book as well. Do you feel that when you were writing it? Did you feel in sort of an exultant place? Because it almost felt that way reading it.
Well, I think the difference between the first book and the second book is that the first book represents a lot of stories that happened in what I would call the decade of death, which was 88 to 98. So kids were dying. And so you had those stories where you're seeing this kid, and you're intrigued by this kid, and you're charmed by this kid, and this kid's very funny. And I went, oh God, how lucky would I be to have a son like that? And then he gets killed, which happened a lot in the first book. But it happened a lot in my life at that time. So then, and it's also reflective of the fact that, you know, we had 1,000 gang-related homicides in 1992 in this county, and now that number's been cut in half and cut in half again. So similarly, that's probably less an issue in the book. And so in the old days, like when I would preach at a juvenile hall or probation camp, I would have almost always the third story in my homily would be this cautionary tale, you know. And it was about a kid getting killed, you know, and I kind of don't do that anymore. You know, I don't even tell those stories again, you know. But I told them at a time when we were in the midst of full-blown horror and war. And so... So there wasn't that intention to kind of make it lighter, but it's reflective of the years that were in fact lighter, you know. I mean, the first book, that was in a time when I, you know, buried 8 kids in a 3-week period. It's like it was unrelenting. So when I reflected back on that and I wrote it, it was from that era. Similarly, when I wrote this new book, it was from another era, you know.
And this era in your life, or perhaps the last few eras in your life, do you think much about how your concept of who God is, what God is, has changed since you were a young Jesuit at the mission? Has it morphed? Has it evolved? Has it changed a lot?
Well, I hope my image of God has changed. You know, that's what has to happen. Anybody's image of God is like baby teeth, you know. You're moving on from baby teeth, you know, and everything is always, you know, you don't want to be stuck in the third grade. You want to graduate to some higher notion of what kind of God we have. Then it becomes more simple and it becomes more tender, and then you eliminate completely the sense of judgment that God has no interest in judging. That because God is too busy understanding, God is supremely able to get underneath everything and be able to see. It's not about behavior. God isn't tripped up by behavior, ever. God knows what language everything is speaking. God knows that this act of violence or this thing, you know. I had a homie wrote me the other day, he said, when God sees me, He doesn't see sin, He sees son. I go, of course, that's exactly right, you know. But that's hard to come by because we're so stuck in this, you know, the God, the one false move God, as opposed to the God we actually have, which is the no matter whatness of God, you know. So I think we're always operating in this thing that there's the God we actually have, and then there's the partial God we've settled for. So you want to be able to always fine-tune that and go, huh, what am I thinking? We're in perilous polarizing times, you know, where, you know, tribalism is kind of the order of the day, as is disparaging the other and people at the margins. And Homeboy wants to be what the world is ultimately invited to become, which is this place of kinship. So now, you know, my own faith place, you know, is about, you know, taking seriously what Jesus took seriously, which is sort of the polar opposite of where we are at the moment. You know, we took inclusion seriously, nonviolence seriously, unconditional loving kindness seriously, and compassionate acceptance. And you can see that what gets embraced currently in the political climate in which we live is exclusion, violence, conditions on our love, and rejection. I had a homie, Miguel, say to me the other day, the homeboy way is the opposite of things. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty good, because I think it is. And so I think, you know, people support us for what we do here, but more than that, I think they support why we do it, you know, and they align their hearts to this, they connect to this belief system that everybody's a whole lot more than the worst thing they ever did, and that everyone believes in a God of second chances. And how can the circle widen and widen? And after it has widened, it widens again. That it's always about widening, so that you've created a community without a single outcast, you know. So, you know, again, faith-wise, that's God's dream come true. That's the only praise God has any interest in, is that you may be one. That's it. And we think it's all these other lesser things, you know, like, oh my God, you're so great. Last thing in the world God wants, you know, that's what we would want if we were God. But that's how you know it has nothing to do with the God we actually have, you know, who just wants you to be compassionate and not spend any time going, oh my God, you're so compassionate. No.
How do you work around when people are coming to Homeboy with, they're charged on fear? Like, does that not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing to be reckoned with, but it's all ignorance, you know. It doesn't mean it's not real, but it's ignorance. And so, you know, everybody comes into this office with heavily burdened with chronic toxic stress. And so, if you can relieve that and give some respite for them, in fact, create a sanctuary where they can feel safe, then they'll trust. And if they trust, then they'll be able to, you know, address the things they're afraid of. But they can't. That's our big error. You know, we kind of wag our fingers at the homeless and say, take your meds and don't get high. You know, well, they're doing all that because they're trying to deal with this chronic toxic stress. Well, the gang population, the same thing. Do good and avoid evil and quit. You know, change your life, measure up. Do better. Can't you be a better person? And yet what they're carrying is such a tormenting thing that unless you can give them safety and security in it, you're not going to make many gains, you know. But here we say, you know, they find this sanctuary here, and then they become the sanctuary they sought in the first place. Then they go home. And they provide that sanctuary to their kids. And now, without really noticing it, you've broken a cycle, you know, because you've, now you have this kind of generational sanctuary where people feel safe, you know, kids feel safe.
I'm wondering, you do so much speaking these days and going out and, you know, touring, and it feels like you'd rather be here, but you do that too. When you go out with this message of community, you know, I agree even more in how little we have of that in the larger world. I'm wondering if you can tell me what hope you see or what response you get when you go out and share this message of community, or when you open your doors for people to visit here, the ripple that by you existing and you all creating this sanctuary, what impact does that have, and how does that translate in the larger world?
Yeah, I think what you connect to is the longing.
Yeah.
There's a longing out there. People connect to it. They get it. I say in talks, especially if they're kind of Catholic or faith-based, you know, I'll say, you know, Whoopi Goldberg was asked in a Q&A, name the living person she most admires. And she could have said anybody, but she said Pope Francis. And then she said, yeah, he's going with the original program. Well, whenever you say that to an audience, people clap, laugh, they acknowledge. What is it that they're acknowledging? They can be Catholic or not Catholic. They can like Pope Francis or not like Pope Francis. They get what the original program is. And it's such an odd phraseology because it's applicable to anything. It's really the widening of the circle. It's the concern for the poor. It's go to the margins and allow your heart to be altered. It's so expansive and such an odd thing that it doesn't fall into any category. Yeah, he's going with the original program. And then people go, yeah, I long for the original program. I know what the original program is. It's inclusive. It's nonviolent. It's soaked with unconditional loving kindness. It's absolutely driven by compassionate acceptance. Yeah, I know what the original program is. I don't even believe in God, somebody might say. But I know what the original program is. So I like that because it connects to what people long for. You know, it's not about make America great again or make America white again. Or people kind of, I read this, somebody had voted for Trump and in the LA Times they said, I just want the country to return to what it was like when I was a kid. Well, if I wanted that, it would mean folks would have to sit at the back of the bus, and there would be whites-only restrooms. I mean, and the list is on and on. I don't want to return to, that's not the original program. But people know what it is. And so my experience in speaking in the country is that people are so longing for the unifying message, not the one that polarizes and sets us apart. People are so longing to hear separation is an illusion. There is no us and them. They're deeply longing for that, you know. But it's hard. People don't talk that way. But I think they'd be surprised at how responsive people are. It goes, yes, this is exactly what we need. This is what we want. This is what we're longing for.
So that end part of the conversation, the one we cut into this week's video, was so representative to me of what Father Greg's new book, Barking to the Choir, really is. In it, he tells stories of taking homies on the road for his speaking gigs and of the incredible stories they tell to his audiences and to him. It's a really funny, joyous book, and it's chills all the way through. You heard me ask him about the place that book came from, why it seemed more exultant than his first book, Tattoos on the Heart. And I thought his answer was so Father Greg. Basically, yeah, it's easier to be lighter hearted when you aren't burying kids you love every day. Think about that. Think about the soul it takes to love the people he seeks out to love, and then to lose them still. It's almost too much to bear. His first book was written when L.A. had 1,000 gang-related deaths a year. And then that number halved. And then it halved again. He'd never take credit for it. But how many of those lives were saved because Father Greg savors the world?